Chapter 32.
This is all of it, ma'am?
The Ruhar teenager asked in a slightly squeaky voice as he tucked her duffel bag under one arm and slung a box over the other shoulder.
That is.
General Lynn Besenson looked around the repurposed shipping container that had been her home and office for the past 3 years.
Yes, she said after she stopped to look under the makeshift desk. That is everything. I can carry one of those.
No, General,
the alien boy said with a buck-toothed grin.
I'm getting paid for this.
Yes, but also, my mother served on Fesnico, the world you call Fresno.
Another flash of buck-toothed grin, then his expression turned serious.
She was wounded and would have died if not for human soldiers cutting through enemy lines to her position. It is...
He straightened up, the box on his shoulder nearly scraping the low ceiling of the structure.
A privilege to assist you, General Besenson.
Thank you.
The box does not go aboard the aircraft, she reminded the boy who stood taller than her. The box, a sturdy green plastic container half the size of a footlocker, contained all the UNEF-issued gear she had to turn in or otherwise account for before she left the planet. Most of everything the U.S. Army or successor entities had provided over the years fell into the otherwise accounted for category, since it had worn out, been expended in training or combat, or been lost, again, in training or combat. She did have a complete set of new uniforms made for her by the Ruhar to the latest Army specifications according to the last communication with Earth. Those uniforms would be going aboard the aircraft, then stuffed into a dropship for the ride up into orbit, and finally, into her cabin aboard the transport ship that would carry her to Earth. Earth. Home. After the better part of a decade, she would see her homeworld again. See her family again. See new family members who had been born after she left, who had no memory of her. For too many years, she assumed she would never see Earth again, that humanity's home was cut off from the galaxy by an unexplained wormhole glitch. She had been able to accept that bitter fact, partly because she feared what the Kristang White Wind Clan had done to the blue and green world she remembered. If the cruel aliens had ravaged the planet and population the way she feared, it was better that she never know. Never have to think about it again. Then came the shocking news that not only was Earth accessible again, it was free from alien control and possessed elder weapons that assured the worst couldn't happen. Everything that happened since that stunning announcement had been a roller coaster, both in personal emotions and how humans on Paradise were viewed by their Ruhar hosts. At first, the Ruhar stumbled over their own feet in their efforts to curry favor with the suddenly powerful humans. Then after the Maxalt's coalition struck back and showed Earth's threats were mostly hollow, the humans who were still on Paradise were viewed with thinly veiled contempt, feared because their presence might attract unwanted attention to a colony world that simply wanted to be left alone. The same Ruhar, who sneered at humans when Earth couldn't defend itself against a simple cloud of gas, were now acting like we had been best friends forever all along, regardless of any unfortunate misunderstandings. The difference was the UN Navy's demonstration showing they were capable not only of giving clients in the Maxalt's coalition a severe beatdown, but that Earth could also wield the ultimate power, selectively crashing wormhole networks. Suddenly, the two senior species had declared a limited ceasefire and were negotiating a comprehensive agreement in three-party talks. There were rumors that the endless war was close to being over, though no Ruhar she knew actually believed it. The best that could happen, cynics declared, was that the long war would enter a new, low-intensity phase. That would be fine with Lynn Besenson. She had seen enough of war and death for a lifetime. Stepping outside under bright sunshine, she donned her Army service cap, tugging it into place so the brim hung down just so. UNEF had relaxed uniform standards over the years of isolation, and it felt mildly silly for her to wear what felt like a slightly heavy baseball cap. But only slightly silly. She was proud to wear the uniform, proud of the respectful look she got from the Ruhar workers who were helping to break down the temporary camp around her.
They knew she was a senior officer, and the better informed amongst them knew she had commanded a starship in action over Squid World, a stolen alien starship in action over a world the Alien Legion was stealing on behalf of the enemies of the Ruhar. For the ultimate benefit of both humans and the Ruhar, though the alien public was still scratching their heads about that one. She took a deep breath, filling her lungs with the clean air of an alien world, and sneezed, for the air was not completely clear. Fine dust hung everywhere, kicked up by the vertical lift aircraft constantly buzzing up and down from the airfield that unfortunately was upwind of the camp. That was a small price to pay for beginning the long trip home.
"General?" the boy trudging behind her asked quietly. "Will you ever come back here? To Getanu? Any of your kind?"
"I do not know." "Probably," she replied, without making it clear that she had no intention of ever leaving Earth again. Certainly, with humanity expanding out into the galaxy, humans would come back to Paradise, if only as diplomatic or military liaisons. The UN Navy would certainly at least visit the world occasionally to show the flag and for nostalgia. They could do it without her. War was a young person's game. Peacetime is great. Really, really great. Really. The great thing about peacetime is, you know, the lack of people shooting at you. The downside is the crushing boredom. Maybe I've become an adrenaline junkie like Smythe. Peacetime had a lot going for it. For example, it was great for knocking items off our to-do list, like bringing the final pieces of Ragnar Station to Fob Jaguar, where it was in the process of being reassembled to Skippy's plans. We had perhaps cut too close moving the station, because a pair of Rindaloo warships showed up while the last bits were being loaded aboard our star carriers. The spiders were mostly curious, actually kind of amused. It seemed to please them that we were making use of a station we stole from the Rotten Kitties to maintain and upgrade ships we stole from the Kitties. Parts of an alien shipyard were not the only things we had moved around now that we had a semi-official ceasefire with the senior species. The last group of humans had been pulled off Paradise and were on their way home to Earth. Personnel from Jaguar regularly rotated back to Earth, while overall the population at our forward operating base continued to expand greatly, with new people shipping in for off-world deployments that were scheduled to last 1 year. Ha! I'm in the Army. I know all about how scheduled deployments get stretched long past their original end dates. Anyway, my parents are happy there, though my mom said yet again that the planet was getting too crowded. My sister? She, her husband, and the baby are staying at Jaguar for now. Plans could change, and that could change where my parents live also. Me? I'm still not setting foot on Earth. I'm too exposed there. Maybe someday, hopefully soon, the danger would be past. Like when our homeworld had a multi-layer strategic defense network in place. I'm not holding my breath until that happens. Another item of good news is that the social unrest on Earth had pretty much settled down now that most people had some hope that the Jupiter cloud would be dealt with before it became a problem. There was a trickle of population movement back north and south toward the poles, those with more faith in the flare program or eager to get a jump on rebuilding or looking to profit from a return to normal, or people simply homesick for Canada or Scandinavia or New England or Moscow or wherever they lived, before hundreds of millions of people fled toward the equator. A not good item of news was that as the population of Earth began slowly moving back north into lands that were thawing out, they ran into disputes with those hardy, or foolhardy people, who had remained in the area as the long winter tightened its grip. Mostly the problems were about looting and vandalism that occurred after cities and towns were largely abandoned and the holdouts who had taken the opportunity to move into unoccupied properties. More serious were the petty warlords who set up fiefdoms in the abandoned areas. Some of them grudgingly accepted negotiated settlements to return the land they'd claimed, but a few hardcore crazies had to be dealt with in a more divisive fashion when they and their followers terrorized or murdered the first groups of people who moved back into the disputed territory. The whole situation was a legal and logistical mess, and I was glad that it wasn't my problem. There was a problem I had to address personally. Someone had taken the long winter as an opportunity to burn down my parents' house. Maybe it was an accident, Someone squatting in the property and a fire in the wood stove got out of control. All I know is the place where my sister and I grew up was gone. Nothing but charred timbers under a pile of snow and ice. There wasn't anything I could do about it. Insurance didn't cover acts of war like the Jupiter cloud. It was likely I would never go back there. Never again walk in the woods where I'd played as a child. That made me sad, and I indulged in melancholy nostalgia for a dark evening. Then I got out of bed the next morning and got back to work. We and the UN Navy, including my special mission group, were relieved that tensions on Earth had cooled to the point where we no longer were constantly at battle stations. Pretty much everyone on and around Earth was publicly pissed at me about the Philippine Sea incident, even if many of them were privately pleased that I had taken care of a problem for them. There were no longer roving gangs of battle cruisers lurking in Earth orbit, aligned by nationality and with their fire control sensors locked on the ships of every other nation. There actually were no UN Navy ships in orbit, since ships there were visible and vulnerable to surprise attack. At all times, a guard force of four courageous class battlecruisers were hiding in stealth, somewhere within 6 light minutes of our home world. A pair of former Jurapta destroyers wrapped themselves in stealth closer to Earth, ready to jump away to alert the big ships to threats. Other than whatever ships were serving in the guard force, or accompanying Valkyrie on the flare missions, all other units were either conducting training or pre-deployment workup exercises somewhere in our solar system. That morning, I saw in the daily report that a pair of Chinese battlecruisers were engaged in a Star Team training program in the asteroid belt. Really, first-line battlecruisers were not the best choice as a platform for special ops troops. But we had Stars aboard Valkyrie for years, so I kept my mouth shut. Yep, peacetime is great. Except for the boredom. Of course, wartime has plenty of boredom also, while you're waiting to shoot at someone or for them to shoot at you. The difference is in peacetime, you know there is no end to the boredom. Maybe I'm exaggerating. My problem was not the boredom of routine for me or even for my crew. I had plenty of work to do. Almost none of it was work I wanted to do. A peacetime Navy shifts focus from delivering ordnance on target to delivering reports on time. Lots of reports. Reports about the status of the ship, reports evaluating the crew, which was difficult because since Valkyrie was being used to train people for service aboard other ships, the personnel rotated through fast enough that I had to ask Skippy to prompt me about people's names. It's not good for the captain to be obviously staring at a person's name tag, or for me to horribly mispronounce a name. With an international crew, there are no foreign names, but there were names I didn't hear as a kid in the North Woods of Maine, so I had to think before I embarrassed myself. The crew was too busy to get bored, because they rotated through, working their way up mostly from our former Theranin ships with the goal of serving aboard one of the courageous class battlecruisers we stole from the Maxalks. UNEF Command thought Valkyrie was a good training platform, because Skippy and Bilby could prevent newbies from harming the ship or themselves. We kept a core of fully qualified personnel of every specialty, so on paper the ship was ready for combat at all times. In reality, any action other than a training evolution required planning 48 hours in advance, so the primary and relief crew personnel could be rested and ready. That was obviously not an ideal situation in a potential combat environment. For us, at the time, it was really no big deal, because it was easy to plan our lives days, weeks, even months ahead of time. You've heard of the movie Groundhog Day? We had Groundhog Weeks. Every day was not like the previous, and operations varied considerably during a week, but what we did every 11-day cycle was the same. I mean, exactly the same. That was our goal. That was the problem. For the crew, getting the ship to perform exactly the same, exactly as planned, exactly on specification, was not only a point of pride, it was a challenge. For Skippy, it was a one-way ticket to Dullsville. The crushing boredom he experienced was annoying and depressing to him, and a problem for me. A bored Skippy is an unhappy Skippy. To keep him entertained, I had to be creative, and that caused trouble. For example, I stupidly volunteered to listen to and give feedback on his Homefront opera. Listening to him took up 17 hours of my life that I can never get back. The opera wasn't that long. I had to listen to it repeatedly so I could provide at least semi-informed feedback on his creation, which I learned much too late was a complete waste of my time.
Hey, Skippy,
I called while stifling a jaw-stretching yawn.
Do you want to hear what I think of your epic opera?
Huh? His avatar appeared, blinking bleary eyes and with one of his feet missing.
Your left foot?
What? Oh, he looked down, and the foot appeared. I was distracted.
By something good, I hope?
I hope so, too. Sadly, no. I was trying to think of something, anything, that could suck worse than this endless operation.
Sorry. It sucks for us, too.
Yes, but it sucks in super slow motion for me. You monkeys only experience 11 days every 11 days. For me, I am longing for the sweet release of death after one cycle that seems to last 1,000 freaking years, you know? Ugh! Will this never end?
You tell me.
Tell you what?
Wow. He was extra absent-minded. That was not a good sign.
Tell me when you will be finished dispersing the cloud.
Ugh. On time?
Ahead of time, actually. I have been able to refine my model now that I have real data. It will happen much faster than I feared, but I will still be stuck doing this for over a year. By this, he meant the ongoing effort to protect Earth by literally blowing the Jupiter cloud away from our homeworld, one minor solar flare at a time. When we started the project, he estimated we needed 35 cycles of solar flares to push the cloud away from Earth until it would not be an issue. Because Skippy and the ship needed downtime between flare clusters, the schedule called for 7 cycles of 11 days each. Those 11 days counted the time from preparing the ship, jumping in near the sun, creating a series of flares, then jumping away so both Skippy could recharge his mental batteries and so we could perform running maintenance on the ship, especially on the energy shield projectors, which were stressed from extended time close to a star. Each evolution of 7 flare cycles was followed by 25 days of heavy maintenance, then we began another evolution of 7 cycles. It would have been nice to get a break, take some R&R at Club Skippy. But rather than flying all the way to Jaguar for maintenance, the fabricator ship Milo had been brought to a secret location near Earth. Before commencing heavy maintenance with the Milo, we rendezvoused with the destroyer so most of our people could go to Earth for R&R. Many of the crew also rotated out at that point, with new trainees coming aboard. 35 cycles in total. We had completed 4 cycles, so there were only 31 to go.
Fun!
It's only another year, Skippy.
It's more than another 400 days, Joe, of doing the same thing over and over and... Ugh! Kill me now, please!
No can do. Sorry. My original plan to get through the suffocating boredom was to drink heavily. But darn it, the UN Navy now had regulations about that sort of thing. Bunch of jerks. All I can say is progress sucks. It made me long for the good old days when we were sneaking around the galaxy, surviving on awful-tasting sludges, terrified that we would fail our mission and doom humanity to extinction. Back then, the only alcohol aboard the ship was the illegal homebrew the crew made from stale bread and sludges, a truly terrible moonshine they thought I didn't know about. Sure, I never drank it, but I could have. It's the thought that counts.
Do you want to hear what I think about your opera?
Oh. Sure. Why not?
Why not?
Skippy, I worked really hard on this.
Sorry, yes, I am eager to hear from one of my adoring fans. Hit me!
I began reading from my notes, with him periodically saying things like very insightful and interesting, and let me make a note of that. It was going well enough until I mentioned one particular section where I thought the libretto, which is a fancy word for lyrics, didn't make sense.
Am I missing something? I can't follow the...
Wait. What are you talking about? That section doesn't belong to Homefront.
It doesn't?
What the f...
I listened to the recording you gave me.
Let me check.
Oops. Well,
it... 17 hours I listened to this thing. I ground my teeth. You better choose your next words very carefully, beer can.
It looks like I kind of
scrambled together Homefront and several other operas I was working on. Truthfully, I bailed on the whole opera thing a couple months ago, so you... I clenched my teeth. What? It just wasn't working out for me, you know? Plus, operas don't go with my fly lil shithead persona, you know? My fans would never understand my amazing breadth of musical interests. Remember when I tried to sample bluegrass music in my hip-hop? Wow, that didn't go over well. I pissed off my fans and the hillbillies. Hillbillies is not a nice way to... Okay, I know that hillbillies could also be hill sallies, but hill people of indeterminate gender doesn't really roll off the tongue, you know? That is not... I smacked my forehead. Oh, forget it. Are you telling me I just wasted 17 freaking hours for nothing? Hey, I never asked you to do it. I know that. That's the point, you ass. I was trying to do something nice for you since you are bored out of your mind. Oh, one of us feels pretty stupid right now, huh? Well, I certainly hope so. Next time you should... I blinked at him. You think I should feel stupid? One of us wasted a lot of time instead of asking me what might cheer me up. Shit. Like I said, you have really dropped the whole opera thing? Damn it. Until that moment, I would have been overjoyed to learn he would never again torture me with his awful extended-form operatic masterpieces. But part of me was disappointed that he didn't care to hear my opinion of the stuff he'd written. I should have kept my mouth shut and counted my blessings. I truly am an idiot. Yes, for now. Come on, Joe. The filthy monkeys down there are not capable of appreciating my genius. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Still, it seems a waste to... Oh, I'm not wasting anything. Recently, to give myself a break from popping out slammin' hip-hop tunes, I have been working to adapt my operas for the Kristang. What? The lizards love opera, Joe. You know that. Sure, but would they want to hear how we gave them a beatdown and... Ugh. I am totally revising the librettos, knucklehead. My first work would be a tragedy about the mythology of their hero Vatbes Ardenvetox. Oh, well, of course. Remind me of, I should say, the opera will be about the mythological version of Ardenvetox, because the real guy was a cowardly dirtbag. Then why? The myth says he single-handedly won a battle that was hugely important to ending one of their civil wars about 800 years ago. The reality is when it looked like he would suffer a crushing defeat in a major space battle, and with it lose a planet vital to his clan, he ordered his ship to jump away, leaving his force behind to be wiped out. Freed from his clumsy and ineffective leadership, his remaining ships rallied to win the battle against enormous odds. The battle is still studied today as a stirring example of the never-give-up spirit of the ideal Kristang warrior. Okay, then why is the opera about this Vetox guy instead of the people who won the battle? Because Vetox returned soon after the battle to claim credit. Also, to arrest anyone who refused to spin the incident the way he wanted. Plus, Vetox hired the most famous composer of the time to write an opera exalting his incredible heroic exploits, and he funded the construction of a dazzling new opera house to host the premiere. Ah, so today no one knows the truth. Huh? No, the truth about him is well known. Am I missing something? If everyone knows this guy is a dirtbag coward who brags about himself, why, Joey, he shook his head sadly. The Kristang warrior cast is full of dirtbags who confuse bravado with bravery. You know the lizards. They admire the sheer brazenness of Vetox rewriting history to make himself look good. Shit. All right. So you are hoping your opera about this guy will be a smash hit in Lizardland? Hoping? You doubt my musical awesomeness? Sorry, I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway, sorry to waste your time. I know you must be busy. Well, it was a nice distraction. Joe Strebick is just about to call you. The ship is secured for jump and fully ready to begin the next cycle. Great, thanks. Are you ready? Ugh, he sighed. Do I have a choice? Yes, actually. You don't have to do this for us poor monkeys. That's why we try to appreciate all you do for us. Try to? I meant, There is no way lowly beings like us can truly appreciate you properly. I fawned over him, proud of myself that I could say it without gagging or rolling my eyes. Right? Correct.
Oh, this is gonna suck.